It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Stanley Kubrick is a giant in cinema. A new book looks at his life and legacy. We'll talk to the author about some of Kubrick's most famous movies. First, as a new vehicle, or maybe a used one, on your Christmas list. Santa may or may not be able to help you out with that. If you happen to be on your own, the good news is this could be one of the best times of year to buy a new set of wheels. And if you're in the market for an electric car, the selection has never been bigger. On the other hand, if you're interested in two-door coupes, four-door sedans, or wagons, you might have a tougher time finding exactly what you want. So if you are in the market, what kind of vehicle are you looking at getting? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Car, truck, SUV, crossover, electric. Is there a certain feature you're looking for? Do you want to hear our guest's thoughts on a particular make or model? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie Page Deaton is the executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. Jamie, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we get into particular vehicles or categories of vehicles, 2020 affected everybody in different ways. How was it weird for the auto industry this year?
Oh, it's been weird in so many different ways. First of all, you know, it threw a lot of economic mayhem into the automotive industry. Right now, the industry is projected to have new car sales at their lowest level since 2011. So that's about 15%, or sales are projected to be about 15% lower than they were in 2019. And, you know, a lot of other economic uncertainty just thrown in around, you know, remember March when everybody went into lockdown, dealers were included in those lockdowns. So a lot of independent dealers were really hit very hard by those, by people not being able to go out and shop for cars, by people getting laid off, not having the money to go buy new cars. And then you also saw that, you know, that was something that consumers could really see. But what consumers may not have seen is the really big supply chain disruptions within the automotive industry. So even if, for example, you know, one country was doing well with the coronavirus, another country might still be in lockdown and have issues, you know, sending parts to be assembled, you know, from Korea to the United States or from Mexico or Canada to the United States. So a lot of automotive companies were really dealing with issues even getting the parts that they needed to build the cars, which is just really, you know, for a lot of consumers, they might have gone to the dealer lot and thought, okay, this is a good time to buy a car, and then been unable to find the exact one that they wanted. But overall, the big takeaway is, you know, this was a strange year overall for everybody, but supply chain issues, there were some issues with sales, and then something that I think a lot of dealers might not be very happy with, but this is the year that we really saw a big shift to pushing more people to buy cars online, where they're completing the paperwork before they even go to the dealership, and just having the car dropped off at their house. So that's a big shift when it comes to the model that most dealerships really follow in selling new cars.
I know a lot of the automotive headlines over the course of a year are built around the big auto shows where people and reporters can go in person and see new models rolled out, cars of the future, and that sort of thing. Those were just all gone this year, right?
Oh, those were all gone, which is, you know, ultimately, when you think about it, that was really smart because these events, everybody's crammed into a convention center. Everybody's touching the cars, sitting in the cars together. I mean, you could not come up with a better super spreader event. But yeah, without those unveilings, automakers had to really scramble to find new and different ways to reveal their cars, you know, not only to the automotive press, but to the general public. So we saw a lot of online reveals, you know, over Zoom with socially distanced teams, you know, at the manufacturer. We saw a lot of reveals that were done just, you know, over social media. You know, if you can't have a, you know, an auto show, well, fine, we'll just hop on, you know, Twitter, or we'll hop on a Discord server and share the car that way. So it was really, you know, in a way, you know, it was a disruptive year. The automakers found a lot of new ways to get their products in front of consumers. Dealers found new ways to get consumers into new cars. And, you know, consumers are going to find, you know, next time you visit the dealership, it's going to be a very different experience. Especially if you haven't stepped in there for the last 5 to 7 years.
We're talking to Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team, getting advice on what cars are on the market. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie, I hear different rumors and legends about different times of year being really good times to go car shopping. And often included that is that end of year time or beginning of the new year. How much truth is there to that?
There's a lot of truth to it. I mean, the week between Christmas and New Year's is historically when we've seen some of the lowest transaction prices in the automotive industry. So that's when people are able to go in, you know, the dealer and the manufacturer, they're trying to not only make those end of month quotas that they need to hit, their end of month goals, but they're trying to make their end of year goals. And for a lot of dealers too, they are really working to clear out older cars on their lots to make room for the newer cars that are coming in for the new model year. So if you can go, and it's also not a time of year when a lot of people are really thinking about buying a car. You know, it can be difficult for people to test drive. I mean, you know, up in Wisconsin, there's probably snow on the ground. It's probably a little bit of a pain to go on a test drive. But if you're really looking to kind of time the market, this week between Christmas and New Year's is a great opportunity to do it. The dealers are going to be more quiet. You're going to be able to negotiate a little bit harder. And because there's not going to be as many consumers there, you're going to likely be able to get a better deal.
It can be a good time to find out how well that car drives in the snow. I've actually done that on purpose before
exactly.
With a test drive.
Yeah, now, exactly. And I mean, you know, especially if you live in an area, you know, where you're getting a lot of snow, test driving in the winter is a wise choice because you don't want to buy a car in July and then find out, oh, this is terrible in the snow.
Let's talk about the 2021 fleet, the cars just out now or just about to be out now. What is your read on what we've seen from automakers in the new lines?
So the big push from automakers is basically answering what consumers want, and what consumers have been wanting for a long time now are more crossovers. So a crossover is basically an SUV that is on a car platform. So you've got the space of an SUV and the ride height that I know a lot of people like, but it drives more like a car. You don't get that bumpy, rough, trucky kind of ride like you do with a traditional body on frame SUV. And so automakers are really pushing into this area, and consumers have a lot of options there. And you're starting to see, too, this segment get even sliced and diced up even more than it had been. It used to be that you would get, you know, a small, a midsize, or a large, you know, crossover or SUV. Now we're seeing subcompact. We're seeing some SUV coupes that have these really great, beautiful, low-slung roof lines in the back. And now we're also seeing a lot of innovation and options when it comes to powertrains. So you can get a pure gasoline-powered engine. You can get a diesel engine. You can get a hybrid engine, you can get a plug-in hybrid powertrain, and you can get a full-on electric SUV or crossover. So really, consumers in this area are spoiled for choice, and automakers are really competing to get your dollars there.
It seems like one of the big stories is a growing availability of full-on electric options. If people are thinking, okay, maybe this is the year I take the plunge on electric, what kind of things should they think through before picking a model and then going for it?
Well, I mean, the first is going to be budget, because one thing that's great now is there is now an EV available for almost any budget out there. Now, if you have a bigger budget, you're going to get, you know, more luxury and likely a larger range. But if you're just looking for an around town, EV, you can get a really nice one for under $20,000 after you add in, you know, tax credits and things like that. So actually, one of my favorite cars that I tested this year was the Mini EV. And, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with the Mini. They're these cute little subcompact cars. An EV is perfect for it. And after all of the tax breaks, it came in under $20,000, which is insane considering how nice the interior is. The only downside of it, though, is the range was only about 100 miles. So it really was just, you know, an around town car. At the other end of the spectrum, though, I just got out of the Ford Mustang Mach-E, which is an EV SUV. It has a 300-mile range. The one I drove was about $56,000. And it had enough room for my family. It had enough room for my dogs. That kind of range, you're not really worried about, am I going to get stuck somewhere? But you do need to consider, you know, where you are and the charging infrastructure that you have. So I don't have a charging station at my house, so I had to go find one in the area to do fast charging. I could plug it into a regular outlet overnight, but it would take honestly, like 8 hours to charge, which is not ideal. But if you live in an area where there are a lot of charging stations, and just find, you know, and you need to find the EV that fits your range needs and also fits your budget.
Let's bring on a caller now. Melody joins us in New Glarus. Melody, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I was very excited to hear about this program because my husband and I are car shopping. And we have been loyal Honda owners for 20, 30 years, actually. We have an Odyssey and a CRV right now, and they both have 360 to 400,000 miles on them. So,
ooh, congratulations.
Oh, I know. We love our Hondas, you know, and this is killing me to have to look at a new vehicle, but we need to. So price-wise, you know, we don't want a brand new. We would buy a newer used vehicle. When we're looking at the lots, you know, we're getting up to 25, 27, 28,000 for a 1 or 2 year old Honda CRV. So we're considering moving one vehicle to possibly a Subaru. And I'm just wondering if you can give some feedback on those two.
Melody, thanks. Jamie, thoughts for Melody?
Yeah, I mean, Melody is running into the problem that I think a lot of shoppers are going to run into, and that is sticker shock. So right now, the average price of a new car is over $37,000, which means that also is driving up the price of used cars. Now, Melody's also fighting another kind of hangover from the pandemic, which is when everybody went into lockdown and stopped buying cars, that also meant that people stopped trading cars in. So there was a huge supply crunch when it came to used cars. When you don't have a lot of supply, that shoots prices right up. So Melody, you're dealing with that. And I know that that's a really tough thing to look at. Between Honda and Subaru, though, Hondas generally retain their value better because they have a better reputation for reliability. In my, you know, and that's a lot of that, you know, in some cases is reputation. I mean, Honda's, just because you have a Honda doesn't mean that it's trouble free. Although I think a Honda is more likely to get you to 300,000 miles than say something like a Jaguar is. But I think between, you know, Honda and Subaru, Subaru makes some very good quality cars. You know, especially if you're comparing the CRV to something like an Outback or a Forester, I think you're going to be happy with both. And I know that, you know, I know plenty of people who've taken their Subarus up to the mileage that, you know, that you seem to be taking them up to, you know, well over 100,000 miles. So I personally would have no problem trading, you know, my Honda for a Subaru. And I really wouldn't have this, you know, concerns about reliability. Because honestly, too, you know, some of what drives that depreciation is not just, you know, in a new car is not just, you know, the reliability rating, but also how much did that car start out costing? Because Subarus tend to start out costing a little bit less than Hondas, then their used models are going to be costing a little bit less than Hondas too. So I think you're fine to go for it, Melody. I would choose a Subaru any day.
Happy shopping, Melody. We're looking at new vehicles of 2021 and getting some car advice from Jamie Page Deaton, executive editor of the U.S. News Best Cars team. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your car shopping questions for Jamie. Again, 800-642-1234, or maybe share your experiences on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation. Take more of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking your questions and comments about new vehicles in 2021. U.S. News and World Report says December and New Year's, good times to buy a new vehicle. Jamie Page Deaton is with us from the U.S. News Best Cars team. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeffrey is with us in De Pere. Jeffrey, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm on a fixed income, but I'd like to get a pickup truck, two-wheel drive, least amount of chrome possible, and same colored bumpers with a somewhat economical engine. Any suggestions? Brand new, 2 years old, 5 years old?
Two-wheel drive pickups. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but it's going to be hard to find that just because not just a two-wheel drive pickup, but any kind of affordable pickup, because right now pickup trucks are some of the most popular vehicles in the country. Automakers really don't have to put a lot of incentives on them. Demand is extremely high. And the other thing that automakers have discovered is people are willing to pay a premium for premium pickup trucks. So a lot of their energies are going into these luxury trucks that sell for well north of $60,000. So that's just a heads up that you might not be able to get exactly what you're looking for. But if you're looking for kind of an older one, you know, a two-wheel drive, you know, midsize Ford Ranger is a really good option there. It's one where it's got, you know, it's not going to have like a huge amount of, you know, towing capability or anything like that, or at least not as big as a full-size truck. But it is going to be probably good enough for most people. You know, you're not going to tow a house with it, but you'd be fine to tow, you know, some smaller boats or even a small horse trailer with it. So yeah, I mean, that's one good one to really look at. But just know that like, it's a really hard truck market to get into right now. You know, you might also take a look at, you know, the Toyota Tacoma. That one still tends to, you know, that's a good used one. It's still going to be a little bit of expensive, but it's got a pretty good engine on it and you can drive it forever. The Chevy Colorado, you know, it starts new at about $25,000. Again, like that's, you might be able to find a used one, but just know that demand is really high right now. So if you're looking for a pickup truck, you're really going to have to fight to find, you know, the exact one that you want.
Good luck, Jeffrey. We'll go to Nate next in Sauk City. Nate, hello.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. You have kind of gotten into an area that pertains to my call. I've been a big platform customer, a Ford Lincoln Town Car for a couple of decades, and unfortunately they don't make them anymore. So I'm looking for a new home. I'm thinking I need a something with a big door and something, you know, kind of easy to get into, not too high. I have thought about the Chevy Colorado. I don't know what kind of mileage they get, but I of course kind of a little partial to the Ford platforms. But I could go wherever I could get a vehicle with the characteristics I described.
Interesting. Nate, thanks. Jamie, any thoughts for Nate?
Yeah, I mean, the Colorado gets, you know, 19 city, 25 highway. But you should know, though, it's not going to ride like your town car is, like not even close. And even if you want to go with Ford, like the Ranger has got 21, 26 for its fuel economy city highway. But again, the ride is going to be, it's going to be truck-like. It's going to be a lot bouncier. And you know, I would really, before you settle on those, really go and see, you know, what it's like to get in and out of it. I would say, though, you know, take a look at some of the midsize and large cars. Now, I know that it sounds like you're, you know, a Ford loyalist and you'd consider Chevy, and those two brands have abandoned cars. They no longer make cars. They're focused on, you know, SUVs and trucks. But I would really encourage you to take a look at the Kia Cadenza and the Toyota Avalon. They're two large cars that are very big. They're very comfortable. They remind me strongly of, and I love those old town cars very much. And so they give you that kind of experience. They remind me strongly of the Chevy Impala as well. And you could also take a look at, you know, if you're really looking for a car, look at the Chrysler 300. It's got kind of that luxury experience that you would have in kind of like a town car or, you know, a Ford 500 or a Ford Taurus or something like that. But take a look at what Kia and Toyota are offering there, and even look at some of the midsize cars, because cars are just getting bigger and bigger. And so a midsize car might give you the space and the door size that you're looking for. When you think about, you know, how much you liked, you know, your town car and stuff like that. And also too, you know, I know a lot of people, they like to buy from American brands because those cars are, you know, they want to support American companies. Know though that like Hyundai and Kia, they build, and Honda, they build cars in the United States. They build cars in Alabama and Georgia and South Carolina and things like that. So you're still, even though you might be buying from an overseas brand, you're still able to support American workers and get the product that you want.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jamie Page Deaton from the U.S. News Best Cars team, getting some advice for car shoppers. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Hubertus. John, hi.
Yes, hi.
What'd you want to ask about, John?
So I just ordered a 2021 GMC Acadia AT4 trim. It's a new trim for 2020. And I'm coming from a 2013 Dodge Durango that I really liked. So I'm downsizing a little bit, but I'm not real familiar with the Acadia. I know the older ones had some issues with their 3.6, but it seems like that's all been resolved. So just making sure I'm doing the right thing as far as making that new purchase on that 2021.
All right, Jamie, do you have good news for John?
Yes, good news. I mean, the Acadia is a great SUV. It's extremely popular, and it's popular for a reason. Like, it's big, it's comfortable. You know, they have had some engine issues, but the nice thing is, you know, you're not buying the first iteration of the current engine. They've had time to work those out. And I think if you're going from a Durango, you're really going to appreciate kind of the upgrades that you'll see, you know, in a newer model like the 2021 Acadia. So yeah, I'd say sit back and relax. You've made a good choice.
Good news for you, John. Thanks for calling in. We'll go to Raleigh now in Oak Creek. Raleigh, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm in the market for an electric car, but I've read, as I'm sure everyone has, there's going to be more and more models coming out soon. They're going to be even better, better range. Wonder if it's worth waiting or perhaps just leasing a current electric or sit on the sidelines and wait for these models to come out.
Interesting. Interesting question. Yeah. What do you think, Jamie?
I'm so glad you brought up leasing because that is, I think, the best option. So if you're not familiar with car leasing, it lets you basically use the car for 2 to 3 years and you only pay for the depreciation of the car during that period. So if the car starts out being worth $30,000 at the beginning of the lease and it's, you know, worth $20,000 at the end of the lease, you're only paying $10,000 in monthly payments over the course of your lease. Now, if you do a lot of driving, leasing is not for you because you have to stay under a certain amount of mileage. But if you're somebody who is waiting for the next big thing, and I've got to be honest with you, I'm in this boat with you. Like, I'm leasing one of my current cars because I know I want an EV, but the EV I want is not on the market yet. So I've got this car lease to just kind of tide me over and keep me on the road till it gets there. And, you know, it's interesting. I mentioned that I was in the Ford Mach-E, and then I was also very recently in the Chevrolet Bolt. Now, the Mach-E is a brand new SUV. The Bolt is EV, and the Bolt is a couple of years old. And you could really see a difference. I mean, the Bolt is a great EV. I don't want to disparage it at all because it is a really good choice. But in the Mach-E, you could see how the charging, how the technology in the battery pack had really improved because it charged from the same exact charging station. It charged so much faster. And that's a big deal with an EV because, you know, I plugged in the Ford Mach-E and I was able to get 20% extra charge in 20 minutes. So basically 1% per minute at the level of charge I was at, which was great. You know, the Bolt struggled to get 15% charge in half an hour. And that doesn't seem like a huge difference because you're talking about, well, 5% in 10 minutes. But over time, that adds up. So I'd say definitely lease an EV now and wait for the next best and wait for them to get a little bit better until you're ready to buy.
And that's all the time we have. Jamie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Jamie Page Deaton from the U.S. News Best Cars team sharing some advice on car shopping this year. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. It's been hard to find art this year with museums closed, but a new project is here to help. Find out how to take a family tour of the art world here in Wisconsin online. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, for 4 decades, Stanley Kubrick made some of the most memorable films in movie history. Dr. Strangelove, Clockwork Orange, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Shining, just a few. Any one of those would have put a director in an important spot in movie history. Legendary filmmaker died in 1999, shortly after finishing his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. Though he's been gone for 20 years, his films have endured and likely will for years to come, and now he's the subject of a new biography that looks at his life, his work, and his legacy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a film fan, what are some of your favorite Kubrick films? What have they meant to you? And do you have movies like 2001 or Dr. Strangelove or some of the others on your list of all-time favorites that you recommend or come back to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. David Mikkix is the Moores Professor of Honors and English at the University of Houston. He's the author of several books. His latest is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks, Rob. Very happy to be here again and happy to talk about Kubrick.
Now, I think a lot of us have probably had that moment where we're watching a bad movie and thinking, I don't know anything about making movies, but I could do a better job than that. Well, cleaning up the language a little bit, Stanley Kubrick had that thought, only it was true. for him. Can you talk about how he went from a photographer to a movie maker from that moment?
Indeed, yes. Kubrick had a very interesting, almost a unique career among major filmmakers. He taught himself how to make movies. As you mentioned, he was originally a still photographer. Straight out of high school, he got a job with Look magazine, one of the two major photography feature magazines in America. And but, you know, he'd been a movie addict since high school, you know, constantly skipping out on school to see double features. And friends reported that he would sit in the seats. When he got bored, he would read the newspaper and mutter, as you said, yeah, I could do better than that. So he read a few books on movie making. He borrowed some money from an uncle. And soon he made his first short newsreel about a boxer and then his first feature.
And looking through his career, his movies were different genres. They look different. They feel different. Is there something you could say, this is a consistent theme, a consistent element that really distinguishes a Stanley Kubrick movie?
You know, Rob, that's one of the most fascinating things about Kubrick. And, you know, I had so much fun writing this book, trying to tease out the relationships among these movies, which, as you say, at first seem so different. And yet they all are very interconnected. You know, in a Kubrick movie, you have an elaborately programmed world, usually, that controls the people in it. And there's a concern with melding human behavior, you know, with turning people into, you know, into functions somehow. And, you know, so we see this in 2001 in Full Metal Jacket, in The Shining, and a number of the other movies. And I think in his final movie, Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick attempts something different. He was, you know, a filmmaker who was concerned with marriage, although people don't often think of him in this way. He made three great movies about marriage, Barry Lyndon, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. And in Eyes Wide Shut, at the end, we get a kind of a freedom, a release from these claustrophobic, horrible marriages that we see in the earlier movies. So there are themes that link these movies together, for sure.
Well, I'm going to throw a bunch of different individual titles at you as we go on, but let's start with the caller doing that at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased that you mentioned Barry Lyndon, because it's an excellent adaptation of Thackeray's novel. And it's at that time, in 1975, I was in film school myself, and I told people I thought it was his greatest film to date, and I see now on the internet that there are others arguing the same thing. There were cameras from NASA that they used to film some of the candlelit scenes that are just amazing. He was such an artist.
Tom, thanks so much for that call and for getting us started. David, I got to admit, I'm about 50-50 on Stanley Kubrick films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Barry Lyndon, one that I haven't seen. Introduce us to it a little more.
Okay, well, as Tom said, it's a very elaborate and sumptuous movie. Tom mentioned the Zeiss cameras that were developed by NASA. This is what enabled Kubrick to use candlelight in the movie. He insisted that all scenes had to be naturally lit. It's a movie set in the 18th century. So, of course, you had to use candlelight. And since Kubrick demanded take after take, the art director, Ken Adam, who actually had a nervous breakdown, you know, he had to leave the movie. Ken Adam was just driven crazy by this, because with every take, the candles had to be burned down to exactly the right setting, exactly the right height. It's a very painterly movie. It's, you know, very lovely. It's very slow moving. It's sort of the antithesis of those sort of slapdash, you know, verve filled 70s movies that we think of, including a movie like Clockwork Orange, which he had made just before. So it really anticipates the taste for the historical romance or the historical epic that we see a few years later with all the Jane Austen adaptations, for example. But it's a very lovely movie.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. We are talking to David Mikix about his book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have thoughts on any of his movies, questions, maybe a fond memory of the next one we'll talk about. We're going to jump around the timeline here. Dr. Strangelove, and I want to give a listen to setting it up here. We're on the brink of nuclear war, and here's the character, the title character, Peter Sellers, as Dr. Strangelove, laying out maybe the upside for the generals and bureaucrats he's talking to. Here's a listen.
I would guess that a dwelling space for several hundred thousand of our people could easily be provided.
Well, I would hate to have to decide who stays up and who goes down.
Well, that would not be necessary, Mr. President. Could easily be accomplished with a computer. And the computer could be set and programmed to accept factors from youth, health, sexual fertility, intelligence, and a cross-section of necessary skills. Of course, it would be absolutely vital that our top government and military men be included to foster and impart the required principles of leadership and tradition.
Also, Peter Sellers as the president there, and the military leaders that he was talking about looking on. Maybe this isn't such a bad idea. David, talk about this absurd movie about the very real fear and risk of nuclear oblivion.
Yeah, it's quite a movie and it's quite a concept. Kubrick, ever since the Berlin crisis at the beginning of the 60s, had become obsessed with the danger of nuclear war. And he even got to know one of the major theorists at the RAND Corporation, a guy named Herman Kahn, who liked to speculate about the consequences of nuclear war. And, you know, we have to take it as a practical possibility. Maybe the war will happen. And then what will we do? So all of this stuff about mega deaths and, you know, how many millions would die in a nuclear exchange, you know, all of that comes from real nuclear theorists, of course. But what Kubrick did, and this is the really radical thing about the movie, is he played this as a wild satire. You know, it's this Rabelaisian, totally extravagant vision of nuclear war. And a lot of people were taken aback by this at the time. I mean, the movie was a huge hit. But there were various reviews that said, oh, how dare he, you know, how dare he take such a sober subject, you know, such a solemn subject and play it for laughs. But what, of course, what he was doing was showing us the absurdity of it, you know, the craziness of it. And that was the only way to get that across. And then we have the remarkable set, the War Room, designed by Ken Adam, who I mentioned, who later worked on Barry Lyndon, you know, one of the greatest sets in movie history.
Something I always remember about that movie, and it probably says something about Kubrick's storytelling ability, that, you know, when you're in the American bomber with Slim Pickens, like you're almost rooting for these guys to pull through and accomplish their mission, and then like, wait a minute, if they do that, everybody in the world dies.
Yes, that is that's great. And there's that great moment when George C. Scott is talking about how the plane is going to get through, and he's very excited by this, as if, you know, he's really rooting for them. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hi. Me being a veteran, I mean, just seeing Full Metal Jacket, I mean, the realism that he portrayed in that, I mean, just seeing the war zones and the training and everything, I mean, it was just so graphically real. I mean, you almost felt like you were there, you know. It was surreal, you know.
Tony, thank you so much for sharing that thought. David, Full Metal Jacket, I think based, you write, on memoirs of a veteran's experience from Vietnam. Talk about how Tony, a veteran, could have that, it's like you were there feeling.
Yeah, exactly. The movie was based on a book by Gus Hasford, who had been in Vietnam. It's a book called The Short Timers, which is now out of print, but quite a good book. And, you know, Hasford was quite a character. You know, I don't have time to get into his life, but, you know, very extravagant kind of roughneck type and, you know, but very funny and wickedly smart. And so Kubrick, along with Michael Herr, who had, you know, Herr was in combat as well and wrote one of the best books about Vietnam War called Dispatches. So they set out to make a movie, which again has an aspect of absurdity, just like Strangelove, that the scene at the beginning, you know, it's the great drill instructor, Sergeant Hartman, played by Lee Ermey, who had actually been a drill instructor. I mean, it's crazy, it's absurd, but as Tony was saying in his call, it also feels very real. You know, that kind of humiliation and that kind of training were actually did and does, I think, take place in the Marines. But also we have in the movie the sense of, you know, there's a certain shapelessness as we go on. The men get lost. You know, the squad doesn't know what to do next. And, you know, it mirrors the actual situation of America in Vietnam. It's like, why are we there? What are we doing there? Nobody really seems to know. And we have the main character, Joker, who I'm not going to give away the ending of the movie, which is tremendous. So no spoilers, but you know, he faces a crisis, a real test at the end. And you can see all the ambivalence in his face as he, you know, as he goes through the final moments of the movie.
Thanks for that call, Tony. We're talking to David Mikic about his new book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. He's a professor at the University of Houston. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences watching Kubrick movies. If you want to nominate a favorite, do you have thoughts on The Shining, A Clockwork Orange, or 2001? We're going to get to in just a minute. Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a bit of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, featured prominently in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film, A Clockwork Orange. We're talking to David Mikic. He wrote a book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. We're talking about Kubrick's career and movies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Peter with us next in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hello. What a fascinating topic for one of the filmmakers that definitely occupies the top of Mount Olympus. I was curious, though, in your book, do you address the fact that Stanley Kubrick's vision, he did not want to compromise by having to work with the Hollywood studio system, and in order to absolutely execute his singular vision, which, his work is outstanding. But is it true that he did finance his own films in order to keep Hollywood from messing up his vision? And was there a specific instance that led him to that conclusion? Thank you.
Oh, great, great, great question. Thank you. Well, as I said, his first movie, his first feature was, you know, financed by a relative, his uncle. But as he went on, of course, he entered the Hollywood studio system. After Dr. Strangelove, which was such a massive hit, Kubrick really felt empowered to demand complete artistic control. In fact, he scribbled a note on a contract that was being offered to him by Columbia Pictures. And the note said that I demand complete, total, final, annihilating artistic control over the picture. So at any rate, that tells you something. But yeah, it was in part his experience on Spartacus. Now, this was his first big hit, Spartacus, which he took over from another director, Anthony Mann, at the request of Kirk Douglas, the star. The movie came out in 1960. But Kubrick had no control over the script. And he said, you know, I kept telling Kirk, this is dumb, the script. Well, this has to be changed. And Kirk would agree with me, and then nothing would get changed. And so Kubrick was very disappointed in that experience. So when he went on to make Lolita and then Dr. Strangelove, he did have complete control over those movies. Now, later in his career, it was really because his movies were made with relatively small crews and were relatively cheap, that he was able to have such control. Warner Brothers executives, his final movies were all from Warner Brothers, from Clockwork Orange on. And the Warner Brothers executives, guys like John Calley and Terry Semel, were very happy to work with Kubrick. And of course, Kubrick worked at a very slow pace. You know, he did not turn out a movie every year or every other year. But, you know, what he did relatively inexpensively. And so they were happy to go along with him. They knew he was a genius. They knew he was a great director.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We'll go to Brian now in Ashland. Brian, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I became a pretty huge Kubrick fan when I was at the UW studying film, and later became a historian and find myself turning to his films to sort of supplement what we've been talking about. Some of the films you talked about, like Full Metal Jacket on Vietnam War, Dr. Strangelove on the absurdity of the Cold War. But one of the films that I seemed to show all the time for World War One was Paths of Glory, which I've not heard mentioned, but is one of his early films and one of the most, I would say, damning anti-war pictures ever made, which also stars Kurt Douglas and probably started their relationship.
Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Talk about, I guess, the lasting influence of Kubrick and how people could use him to illustrate not just film history, but history, David.
Yeah, well, Paths of Glory is a great instance. I mean, it's a very, although, you know, Kubrick actually made the trenches wider than they were, you know, so that the camera that he wanted could get through the trench. But by and large, it's a very accurate film, and it depicts a great scandal in French military history, in which a group of generals decide to have some men executed for symbolic reasons. So the movie was actually banned in France for decades. And, you know, despite Kirk Douglas's enthusiasm, Kubrick had a hard time getting a studio to take it on. It came out from United Artists. But yeah, the idea was that, well, you know, the French are going to ban it. And anyway, war movies are death at the box office. This is 1957, and there have been several big flops in the war movie genre just before that. But it is it does give you a remarkable feel for World War One combat when Douglas is crawling through no man's land, and there's a tremendous score by Gerald Fried, who was a high school buddy of Kubrick's. It's all percussion. And, you know, you see him, he's being filmed by a handheld camera, you know, just crawling slowly with these bombs bursting around him. And these are real explosions, too. It's not the usual shower of dirt that you get in a war movie. But Kubrick, you know, Kubrick made sure that you get actual pieces of metal flying through the air. So, yeah, there's a lot of very precise, obsessive detail that, you know, adds to the historical accuracy in this instance.
Thanks a lot for that call. I'm going to end giving you a one-minute challenge, David. A friend of mine watched 2001, your favorite, recently, and said, you know, with our fast-paced entertainment now, it felt slow watching it. Make the case that we should retune ourselves to that pace and re-watch or watch for the first time 2001.
Oh, you should. You should so much. Well, you know, there's a challenge here, of course, because now not only during COVID, but even before that, we tend to watch movies at home. And 2001 especially seems to demand a big screen. You know, it's just sort of it you get immersed in it. It surrounds you. It's a whole world. It's a whole universe. And, you know, if you're just sort of watching a bit and then making dinner and going back to it, you know, you lose that feeling. So I would say sit down, watch it. You know, if you have a big screen at home, that's perfect. And just give yourself over to it. Just surrender to it. Forget about time. My 10-year-old did it. My 10-year-old boy is actually a big fan of 2001. And so it can be done and it should be done. Yeah, I love it. The first really speculative movie made by Hollywood where you had to wonder, what does this all mean? What about that ending? And it was one of MGM's 10 biggest moneymakers, you know, a complete success.
That's a great place to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to David Mikix. His new book is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, COVID-19 case numbers leveled off here in Wisconsin after a peak in November, while national numbers have gotten really big. We'll get the latest and answers to some of your questions with a Wisconsin public health expert. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. When the Bidens move into the White House next month, it'll mark the return of a long tradition of American presidents, the White House pet. The Bidens say they're adding a cat to the roster, and they already have two dogs, including a rescue dog. This would not be the first rescue animal in the White House, though. A while back, I talked about the family of mice that Andrew Johnson adopted and took care of during his impeachment. Since then, I came across the story of Rebecca, the White House raccoon. Reading up in various sources, I learned that Rebecca wasn't supposed to be a pet. A Mississippi resident sent it to President Calvin Coolidge in 1926. Rebecca was meant to be Thanksgiving dinner for the Coolidge family. President Coolidge observed that turkey was just fine by him, thanks. But the family grew attached to the raccoon and ended up adopting it as a pet. Rebecca roamed around the White House apartments, participated in the Easter egg hunt on the White House lawn, cuddled with the family, and even traveled with them on trips. Being a raccoon, she sometimes climbed trees or telephone poles and had to be coaxed down. At one point, the president was seen with mysterious bandages on his hand, which were never explained but are assumed to have been raccoon bites. Rebecca got a brief stint at the zoo after that. When the Coolidge administration came to an end, Rebecca retired to the zoo for good. National pet news you can use. This is Central Time.